like smoking lightning. Heavy metal thunder racing with the wind, and the feeling that I'm under. Yeah, I gotta go make it happen. Take the world in a loving embrace. Fire all of your guns and what's in, explode into space like a true nature's child. Welcome back. You're listening to Tide Smart Talk with Steve on News Talk WLOB, 13:10 a.m. I don't know how we picked this intro song, Deb. Was that you, Born to Be Wild? That fits our guest. That's what you're thinking?
That's what we're thinking.
Oh,
yeah.
Yeah, On the Highway.
Mm-hmm.
We have the gentleman who is in many ways in charge of Maine's highways. We've got Peter Mills, the executive director of Maine Turnpike Authority here. Hey, Peter.
Hi, how are you?
I've never been happier.
Good.
Never. Thank you for asking. Now we're entering a Memorial Weekend, which is always fun. And there's a rumor that our long cold winter may be ending this weekend. I haven't seen
the temperature's going to drop to 30 something this
weekend. I know. Oh, it was supposed to be 38 like tomorrow morning at 2 in the morning.
But you know, the traffic's back. We're thinking at the Turnpike that this year may be the highest traffic year in the history of the Turnpike, which is saying something because 2006 and 2007 were the previous high spots. And if that's the case, then Maine, at least as far as traffic and tourism is concerned, might be able to say that it's climbed out of the recession.
I don't have the technical data that you're probably looking at, but just going around the state and being down in Portland and the Old Port, feels like there's much more activity, there's more people, we've got a few more hotel rooms, so there's plus with gas prices down. My data shows the same thing, Peter. It's not, it's more, you know, me just kind of sticking my finger in the air and guessing which way the wind blows, but I'm thinking you're right.
Yeah, I think Greater Portland certainly is fully back. The question is what's happening in the mid-state regions and the rim counties.
Great. Before we start talking about the Turnpike, which is interesting, and it's the kind of the transportation hub that runs through Maine, wanted to talk briefly about your background. You know, you were here a couple of years ago, and we talked about you growing up in Farmington. And for any of our listeners that are not aware, Peter's part of a very active family, both in terms of politics and policy here in Maine. Sister Dora headed up Maine's health department for many years. And Janet is our attorney general, who I think is doing a great job up in Augusta. And Peter himself has served 16 years in the legislature and very involved in policy and law. But being Memorial Weekend, which to me is a very important day of remembrance.
Yes,
I think here in Maine, particularly where we have so many active people in the military and so many people who have sacrificed in our country's history. You had a long and distinguished military career. If you wouldn't mind sharing some of that in terms of your military background. We talked, I was joking with you about your NSA file, and you mentioned, well, I did some spying on the Soviets. And just talk a little bit about your background in the military. I'd really like to, whenever possible, show respect and really appreciation for both yourself and your service, but for the listeners and for people who have family members that either served or sacrificed. And why don't we start there with your military perspective?
Well, the Navy was always very good to me. When I was 17, I took some exams and I was given a scholarship in exchange for which I gave them 5 years of service after I got out of Harvard. But they paid my tuition you know, those programs are still available, I think, in part, but they were, in those days, you could go through college, and if you played your cards right, you could graduate debt-free, and that's no longer, I think that's essentially no longer possible in our society. It's too bad, really. Anyway, I was in the Navy on destroyers from 1965 through 1970 as a communications and an operations officer, and we went to Vietnam a number of times, but my last tour of duty in 1969 and 70 was out of Pearl Harbor in Hawaii. I was on a little destroyer escort, and the principal value of that vessel was that it was fuel efficient. It had four diesel engines in it and a single screw, and if it ran on one engine, it could go. It didn't go very fast, but it could stay underway for weeks and weeks at a time. And they would send us on very short notice sometimes, I had my bag packed at all times. Sometimes on a couple of hours' notice, we would get underway, bingo, and head out for the Central Pacific in order to watch missiles that were coming in from the Soviet Union and to see the results of their testing. And we had one experience that I can recall where we observed a missile coming in with three warheads, and we were able to detect exactly where those warheads landed in relation to the ship and their position on the face of the Earth, certainly. We had one of the world's first satellite navigation systems. There were only 12 or 13 in the world at that time.
Wow.
We had one of them. It was a big box about as big as a cigarette dispenser. It was huge. And you could only get a fix once, I think, four or five times a day, depending on when the satellite was actually coming over, because it was only just a couple of satellites that you could signal on. And the thing was huge, and then it spit out tape and word for 15 or 20 minutes. And then at the end, it would tell you exactly where you were. Now, it's just the same way that your cell phone will do it from your pocket today, but this machine was gigantic. Anyway, we knew where we were, and the Soviets only knew where they were by doing celestial navigation. And, of course, that only gets you down to an accuracy of plus or minus a mile, maybe, or
right,
three-quarters of a mile. And but our little machine would tell us where we were down to about 50, 60 feet, just the same way that you can do today.
I think that was one of the byproducts of our investment in the space program, because we had more
right
satellites up quicker. And
yeah,
as anyone knows now, and I think we all take it for granted, we talk about GPS as if it's something that has been around forever. But
well, we were very successful in identifying exactly where these warheads were coming in, and they said... I was in charge of gathering all the data and sending messages back to the intelligence headquarters and so on. So we get a message that said, proceed, best speed, Pearl. So I got there, and I got out. The minute the gangplank went over, there was a full Air Force colonel sitting there saying, Lieutenant Mills, where's your chart? I handed it to him, and he thanked me. And then
wow,
a week later, the thing was essentially in Time magazine. And the reason was, Richard Nixon at that time was attempting, this is 1969, so, he was trying to get through Congress an anti-ballistic missile defense program where you would shoot down incoming Soviet missiles with another missile before they could hit us. And one of his justifications, one of the justifications that he used with Congress was the findings from this intelligence mission, which said, look, the Soviets now have the capacity at that time to send a missile up in the air that would have three warheads that would come down in a triangle that was configured almost precisely as our missiles, our Minuteman missile silos were configured all across Minnesota and North Dakota, so that they would have the capacity, in theory at least, to take out three of our Minutemen with only one missile getting through, but with three warheads on
wow
the top. So he used that as a reason to get Congress to vote for it. It didn't succeed. Congress didn't buy it. And indeed, all of these anti-ballistic missile systems since then have proven to be very, very difficult. It's when you're trying to shoot a bullet to hit another bullet, it's pretty hard.
Talk a little bit in the 60s, in the mid-60s and late-60s, serving in the Navy. And I remember, I'm a couple of years younger than you, but I remember a general feeling of, and again, back then there weren't computers, telecommunication was limited, there were three channels on TV. So what people knew was much more limited than the information now, where yeah now everything is instantaneous. But there was a general fear about what was going on with the Soviets. There was a general issue in the country relative to Vietnam, which we were in the midst of. Things were very progressive, and it was just one of the most turbulent times in the military. And then at home, it was a turbulent time relative to civil rights and what was going on.
Yeah.
What's your recollection to the mood of serving at that time?
I can remember observing or being witness to so many events from such a distance. I was on ship out in the Western Pacific or the Mediterranean for so much of that period during 65 through 70, but you'd get news flashes saying, oh, Martin Luther King just got killed. And Bobby Kennedy got killed. They just shot four students in Ohio. There was a sense that those of us in the military with short hair had really very little idea of what society was going through back. I just felt so distant from the culture that I was reading about. And I came home in 1970 to go to law school in Portland and tried as best I could to tune back in to American society. But I felt as if I'd been Rip Van Winkle for 5 years, sort of absent from it.
It feels like with Vietnam vets coming back, there was less acceptance because it was more social unrest and it was more controversial. What was your feeling, particularly coming back to Maine from the Vietnam War? There had to be a lot of confusion both with people coming out from the war as well as assimilating back into a society that never really embraced the righteousness, I guess, of the Vietnam War.
I think we had some sense when the truce was negotiated in Paris in 1972, I think it was, I think we had the sense, well, okay, so it's another career. We're going to have a South Vietnam like we have a South Korea, and we'll have a North Vietnam like we have a North Korea. And, you know, it was another fight to sort of a standoff, and it wasn't all that satisfactory, but we, you know, would live with it. And then 2 years later, when it became, somebody said that as long as Nixon had remained in power, the North Vietnamese knew that he was crazy enough to go right back in there if they didn't abide by the terms of that treaty. But when he left office and when the North Vietnamese came down in force and took over the rest of the country, I think there was kind of a sinking feeling among many of us. You know, we lost 50,000 of our own troops. God knows how many Vietnamese were killed in that effort. And you began to think, was any of it worth it? And I think historically, as we look back, many of us say, oh my God, what did we get into? Why did we get into it? And look what happened. And, you know, some of us are concerned that, you know, did we really, where was that lesson when we decided to go into Iraq? And you know, how many times do we have to relearn that lesson?
But let's talk about that for a minute, because we have Peter Mills here in the studio. He's the executive director of the Maine Turnpike Authority. He has also served in Maine State Legislature for many, many years, headed up tax, labor, judiciary, appropriation committees, very involved in the state his entire life. My recollection, both from the Vietnam War and other conflicts, was very similar to yours, where people look back, and even to this day, despite being taught in civics and history courses, I think there's a general, like, Deb, do you have an understanding of the Vietnam War? I don't want to put you on the spot, but in terms of what was the catalyst and what was the imperative, and then we needed the draft to make sure that we had enough military forces. And then when it ended, I still don't know. Here we are in 2015.
I don't either. I'm not real sure either.
What was the success in Vietnam?
Yeah, there was very little success.
How did the United States connect to that conflict? Because it feels like sometimes I don't know if it's arbitrary, but sometimes there's other issues, geopolitical issues. In the Mideast, there are issues involving, sometimes it has to do with oil, it has to do with it's happening over there, but how the U.S. decides, when do we stand up and say we're going to be involved in this issue, or maybe in Central and South America and Africa, we make the decision not to engage? And coming from the experience that you've come through, Peter, which, you know, your service in the military, and as we're on, you know, we're in the middle of Memorial Weekend, why is it that those lessons do not carry on? Is it in the political realm, there's so much inertia for decision-making and for military intervention? Because you're part of a generation where many, many of the people making those decisions in the last 10, 15 years with Iraq and Iran and Afghanistan and Pakistan, but it feels like we study history, but we talk ourselves into thinking it's different now. Are there any parallels to Vietnam, to the Mideast, that frustrate you in terms of your perspective?
Well, there's a new situation in the Middle East, and that is this ISIS crowd is a threat to everybody. And what really bothers me is why NATO as a whole isn't getting in. Why is it Why is it the United States' sole responsibility to go plunging in there and try to take these guys on? I mean, they're fighting. They're willing to commit suicide in order to take over real estate, which is a whole new phenomenon we haven't seen, since the Japanese did it at the end of World War II, really. And they're very, very dangerous. There is no remedy except to crush them. And they are a threat to the entire free world. And why France and Germany and Great Britain in this particular conflict are sitting on the sidelines while it's up to what's left of the Iraqi army and the United States to take on the burden of policing these people. I don't get it. I don't understand why the free world doesn't muster around this cause and get in there and crush these people.
Well, I mean, you asked what was, in essence, a rhetorical question, but there must be answers. You know, I think part of it is the United States, we are the leading global power. Our economy is the strongest. We have the biggest military. We've made policy decisions. But, I mean, I look at it as we're all on, you know, planet Earth, and we're hurling through space. And there's some parts of the world that are less civilized than others. And there are some parts of the world where people are doing awful things, and there's genocide and there's death and
they're
killing. And as a moral people, civilized people, I think we all have an obligation to say, to stand up for human rights. But it feels like other countries kind of step back a little bit, whether it's a political thing, a military action, or sometimes when it's a health issue, when there's catastrophe around the world. America is almost by default, everyone looks to America, and how do you change that?
We had a fair amount of help in Afghanistan. The Aussies were there, the Brits were there, and there were other countries involved. But these ISIS people have taken it on. They're a whole new dimension. I mean, those people are just about as close to pure evil as humanity can produce. And look at the harm they're doing to people. I mean, they take over territory and then they slaughter civilians just to get rid of them.
But is it when a person has nothing left to lose and there's nothing that's controlling, there's no other motivation?
I don't know. I think they're rabidly religious. They're power crazy. And it's hard to understand all that there is there as part of their motivation.
There doesn't seem to be any reasoning with these guys.
We're never gonna,
it's like a cancer.
You're never going to go sit down with them and make a deal.
No.
I mean, they're deals.
And so you're right when we say we have to go in and stomp them out. But yet I think that in today's society, we have too much of the, we'll talk first. We'll use diplomacy. But there are some times when that's not going to work and you know it up front and you have to act. And I don't think there's a will for that.
I think you can talk to some of, you know, like Iran. I happen to think that the idea of making a treaty with Iran is probably not a bad idea. I don't trust them very much. But on the other hand, they're not insanely crazy like these ISIS people.
Well, we've got Peter Mills here in the studio, executive director of Maine Turnpike Authority. Without jumping off of the whole geopolitical thing, do you have any thoughts about Cuba? In the last few months, there's been some thawing of what has gone on now for about 50 years, which has been, you know, the U.S. policy is both trade embargo, like everything else in the political realm, there's controversy on both sides. People are saying, hey, we shouldn't recognize the Castro brothers because of the human rights violations, whereas President Obama basically said, well, you know, this is something that's gone on for 50 years and maybe having some discussions and some openness and willingness to talk will have a positive effect. And if people in Cuba see either opportunities or have more exposure to what's happening in America, then that will accelerate positive change and maybe some element of democracy in Cuba.
I think there's some sense that the brother was and is prepared to be a little more receptive than Fidel, and, you know, without undermining Fidel's legacy. Neither one of them is going to last. They're in their mid-80s.
Right.
And late 80s. And so I think now it gives us an opportunity to have some impact on who the successors are and what their attitudes are. So I thought the timing of it was appropriate. And let's just see what happens. You know, it also gained us. The other advantage really is that opening up to Cuba gained us a great deal of cachet with the rest of Latin America. Our interests there are probably far greater than our relationship to this very tiny economy that Cuba is trying to manage.
Yeah, it's not like the embargoes either worked on our behalf or on their behalf. By all accounts, life in Cuba is rough.
It leaves us with maybe just one hostile country left down there, and that's
Venezuela.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, I was actually in about 40 or 50 years ago. I was in Caracas, Venezuela.
Really?
Yeah. And in looking at what's going on down there now, it's kind of bizarre. I was on a cruise, and one of the stops was Caracas.
Really?
And on one side of the road, when you go into town, was just these palaces and, you know, opulence. And on the other side, thousands of little shacks up on a hill.
No kidding.
And it was, and I was 10 years old or something, it was a family cruise, and it was like, you know, it was like it turned to my parents, and it's like, you know, Dad, I thought this was supposed to be a fun family vacation, and it's like we're in the middle of Caracas.
Wow.
Anyhow, hey, we've got Peter Mills here. Let's bring it closer back to Maine. You've been involved in almost every area of government and community leadership since growing up in Farmington. We'll start with talking about the Maine Turnpike Authority, where for the last, is it 3 years you've been
four and a quarter now, yeah. So March of 2011.
Yeah, and without dragging up bad news, but you came in because there was a bit of turmoil going on. Your predecessor apparently really liked the credit cards or liked spending on behalf of the Turnpike Authority. So big controversy, that had to be resolved, and then all of a sudden they go to the bullpen and they go, who can we put in this high-profile role that is above reproach? Let's go see if we can find Peter Mills.
Yeah, I was out in the woods cutting this.
Literally, you were out in the woods.
Yeah, I got a cell phone call, and I was out with my chainsaws cutting ski trails through some woodlots that I own, and somebody says, why don't you get down to Portland? Because they're trying to figure out who to run the turnpike. I drove down and I came back with, I don't know if I even came back. I had the job. So it was kind of exciting.
Well, for people everyone's familiar with what the Maine Turnpike is. But if you wouldn't mind taking a minute, just kind of explain how our highway system is set up here in Maine, what the interstate system is about in terms of I-95, and what the jurisdiction is of the Maine Turnpike and how the funding is set up relative to tolls and why the Maine Turnpike is different than 295 or other roads here in Maine?
Yeah, the Turnpike was the second toll road in the United States, second interstate toll road built in the United States. It's quite interesting because Pennsylvania was the first, and it was the funding mechanisms for Pennsylvania were set up in 1938 and 39 at a time when there was a lot of federal money flowing down to try to jumpstart the economy under Franklin Roosevelt. And there were three Maine legislators who met in the Augusta House in 1941, sitting around the table, and decided to create an enabling act to create the authority for a turnpike, and they got it passed without any fanfare at all. I've read the record. There's no record. It's just the statute got passed. There was no floor debate, no discussion, nothing. But the problem was they had no money. I mean, they didn't. Pennsylvania had, millions of federal dollars flowing in, both loans and grants to get it jump-started. And then they had tolls, of course, and they could fund bonds on those tolls. The guys that started it spent the whole of World War II trying to figure out how do you start something out of nothing. So by 1946, they wound up getting an engineering firm to do all of the work on a contingency fee basis. They would get paid their huge fee for doing all that work only if the bonds could be sold. So they laid out this plan from Kittery to Portland, to basically Outer Congress Street, 40-odd miles of road. And then they went to the banks and they said, can we underwrite this on the basis of future speculative tolls? And the bank said, yeah, for a fee. So they charged a huge underwriting fee. And they launched it. And then in 47, 48, and 49, they couldn't pay, the turnpike could not pay its bills. It was tough. They raised tolls and they struggled to get traffic onto the road. And finally, by 48 or 49, it started to come into its own, 49 and 50. And then you know, by the early 50s, they were strong enough. They were able to consider going to Augusta. And they wrote bonds on the strength of their toll history at that point and were able to continue bootstrapping it. As a result, it's one of the few roads in the United States where there's been no federal money, no state money. It's run entirely on tolls, still is to this day. And it's 109 miles long, six and four lanes, depending on where you are. And it carries about 9% of all of the vehicle miles traveled in the state of Maine, just on that 109 miles.
Well, we'll talk about the economics a little bit, which is kind of a huge issue here in Maine in every dimension. But if it's 109 miles long, and much of the early cost had to do with building infrastructure and bridges and asphalt and all the excavation, at what point is the overall capital cost of the infrastructure paid for? And then at what point are the tolls basically for maintenance, for upkeep, for public safety? And at some point, doesn't that number reduce?
Yeah. Again, that's a good question.
Doesn't it lower?
Everybody asked me that. The bonds that built it, there were two sets. There was one set in 47 to build the first half, another set in 1955 to build it to Augusta. By 1982, those bonds were paid. The turnpike was debt-free in 1982. My predecessor, by two people, the one before, the one I took over from, Dave Stevens, went to the legislature and said, okay, the road is yours. Do you want the pike? And the legislature had just come off. If you remember the 70s, we had two gas crises in the 70s, 73 and 78.
I pumped gas at a Gulf station in Needham, Mass. In 73. Do I remember it?
Lines were forming.
Lines, and you'd have on one day odd numbers on your license plate. It would be on a Tuesday and even on a Wednesday. And I used to pump gas and tell people, I'm sorry, you've got an even plate. Get out of line.
That's right.
So I remember it, and I felt it.
Well, the price of gas went from 35 cents at the beginning of that decade to $1.40. It multiplied by four during that time period. Joe Brennan ran for office in 1978 saying, I will not raise your gas taxes. They at that time, it was 9 cents a gallon. He says, I'm not raising your gas taxes. People were driving around in these new Volkswagens, and they weren't paying it. So as a result, we were running on much less fuel than we had before because we had learned to be economic. Our cars were coming off the assembly line as being much more economical. And so the gas tax itself, which is a per-gallon tax, was devastated.
It suffered.
It plummeted.
Right.
So they had, in 1981, they were designed, right at the same period as we are today in the legislature, you know, an odd-numbered year where you've got to put a budget together. They could not get a transportation budget together because there was no money in it from the gas tax. And Brennan had said, I'm not raising the gas tax. That's off the table. And they took all the money they could squeeze out of the general fund, and that wasn't anywhere near enough. So in June of 1981, as the legislature needed to go home, they put three men in a room, and Joe Sewell was president of the Senate, said, you guys go into that room, and when you come out, you're going to have a damn transportation bill. And well, I don't care what's in it. What's in it is going to get rammed through the Senate, and we're going home. And the bill said, keep the turnpike, increase the tolls, and take about a quarter of all those tolls and give it to the DOT to balance the budget. All during the 80s, the turnpike supplemented the transportation. In the 80s and the early 90s, the turnpike was a major source of funding for the Department of Transportation. That came to an end in the mid-90s when it became necessary to completely rebuild the turnpike south of Scarborough, to go to six lanes, take all the old bridges out, move the abutments back so you could get six lanes through, replace all the bridges. All of that work had to be done, and then they made a deal under Angus King to get rid of that constant subsidy.
Wow. So, I mean, isn't the principle of a toll road—
Today, we've got many of those built. The bonds that were taken out to widen the turnpike have now been, thanks to this recent bond market, we've converted them to 3% bonds, and we are now paying those bonds down very rapidly, and we're running the turnpike now entirely out of cash. We're not borrowing anymore.
What's the forecast over the next couple of decades? Will there ever be a point where the bulk of the infrastructure is already paid for and most of the big capital expense are manageable, and then tolls will go down, or will the money always find a home?
The current toll structure has no reason. We can't see any reason to ever increase it in the next two decades. But on the other hand, it is just about enough to continue running the pike and meet all of its capital needs without – and the capital needs include replacing bridges when they get to be 60 and 70 years old in many locations. Mm-hmm. But we can run the turnpike as it is and still get the bonds paid over time. But we need to remember that it costs a lot to run the turnpike. If you turn the turnpike over today – forget about the bonds for a minute – if you just took the running expenses and you turned it over to the state would have to generate about 10 cents on the gas tax to pay for the operating costs of the turnpike and the capital.
If there were no tolls.
Yeah, and so...
If you made a public road as opposed to a toll road.
Yeah, and that's been done in other states. In New Hampshire, the toll road in New Hampshire is a department of the Department of Transportation. It's a division of the department. So, I mean, it can be done. It's just that you've got to have the courage to pony up. If you want to get rid of the tolls, you have to find another source of revenue.
Right.
Now, the hard part there is 66% of those tolls are now being paid by out-of-staters. We've got the toll structures with this new discount that we're offering to Maine Easy Pass holders. Just about one-third of the cost of running the turnpike is coming out of state people, and the rest of it is out-of-state. So that's not true of the gas tax. The gas tax is probably... 20% out of state, 80% in state. So if you went to the gas tax, you'd be shifting the burden back onto Maine people.
Interesting. We've got Peter Mills here. He's the head of the Turnpike. Talk a little bit about the Easy Pass. I remember, I don't know if it was a decade ago or longer, that the technology started coming online to replace toll collectors, which at the time seemed like a great idea. And I think the technology continues to be improved. It used to be you had to go slow. Now there's a couple sections in the turnpike where you can go highway speed, so the pickup technology on the Easy Pass and the car has gotten better. Cooperative agreement with other states have gotten better, where you can now travel most of the East Coast with the same main Easy Pass. Mm-hmm. And obviously you're able to cut down labor because for every automated Easy Pass lane, there's a toll collector or maybe three, because you need to staff them 24 hours a day, at least most of the time.
That's right.
So how does Easy Pass work in terms of the economy of the turnpike and the operation? And are there any changes in the next few years you see happening with that kind of automation?
Well, 10 years ago, 12 years ago, it cost us about 26% of our revenue. Over a quarter of our revenue went to the cost of collecting that revenue. Today, it's down around 13%, so it's about half what it used to be.
And much of it's labor and benefits.
Largely because of the automation. I will also say it's also because tolls have gone up somewhat. But it's a continuing gain on efficiency as life goes on. Those, interestingly enough, the high-speed tolling is phenomenal. When we opened up New Gloucester, before we allowed it to be used, we ran police cruisers through there at 100 miles an hour, and the Easy Pass
was
99.5% of the time. Yeah. I mean, it's not 100% perfect, but it's standard.
That's Deb's average speed.
Oh,
so
man.
I think that's...
So it'll work if I go through.
Just make sure it's...
That's Deb.
You want to use those Velcro strips so it's on your windshield, because that's the ideal posture for the antennas.
Yeah.
If you put it on your... So a lot of people just toss the transponder on top of the dashboard, and it will work, but it will lose. We find that about 10 to 15% of the time it will not register properly. But on the other hand, if you register your plate with us, if you open up an EasyPass account, buy a transponder, tell us which license plate is associated with that transponder, or maybe there's two, mm-hmm. you give us that. So when you do go through, and if it doesn't read, we pick up your plate on a picture, a photo, a very high-resolution photograph. All it does is take your license plate. We don't get your picture individually. And then we match it up in the back office, and we debit your account, and you're still running.
I'm an Easy Pass holder. I love it.
Yeah, I loved it. I was actually just in Colorado a few weeks ago, and I don't know what their system is called. It's not called Easy Pass, but they've done away with toll collectors, and you have to register as part of your car registration, your license plate. And so everyone on these toll rolls, and I don't know if it's throughout Colorado or in the Denver area, I was in the Denver area, has Maine looked at something like that? Because if you connect the debit to an account linked to a license plate,
right,
you take one step out of the process and you just bill people directly. Or, you know, there's got to be pros and cons to every system, right?
It's one thing if you're dealing with plates that are almost entirely from one jurisdiction. It's very hard to think about implementing a system like that in Maine. It's in Denver, it's one road, and it's in the vicinity of the airport around Denver.
Right.
And they were one of the first states to decide to go to what they call all electronic tolling, and they abandoned cash collection. They've done that on the Tobin in Massachusetts for the obvious reason that they were backing up traffic trying to get into. You may remember they used to charge you going in and out, then they just charged you going in. But mornings at 8 o'clock on the Tobin were frightful, and so they're now sending out bills by mail, tens of thousands of them. It's a huge back office undertaking. It is. If you can convince everybody to go to Easy Pass, that's fine. But if you can't, and they haven't been able to, then it's a huge back office burden to process those payments.
I mean, when you look at technology in other areas, whether it's in automotive technology or iPhones, we're all going to end up with little chips in our head, right?
Yeah. Bill my account.
I know. It'll all be, you know, everyone's identification, whether it's, you know, everyone has specific DNA, everyone has fingerprints.
As long as we can keep the Civil Liberties Union out, it'll be fine. We'll all have that.
Public service announcement was from Republican Peter Mills.
I even agree with him to some extent. I think it is. I think there are limits to what our society will permit.
It feels like technology makes it a slippery slope. Because it was a little easier decades ago when civil liberties, it was more clear cut whether it had to do with search or your household or car, because you could see the parameters of privacy and invasion. But with technology and information and email, you can't see it. It's kind of this abstract thing.
I think if they could read, what is it? Your iris that they can read. It's high, that everybody's iris is completely unique. If I could set up, a debit account to my eyeball, I wouldn't have to have anything.
I know, but then haven't you seen Mission Impossible? Then somebody takes a picture of your eyeball, they make a little contact lens, they put it on their eyeball, and then people start going through the main turnpike with free Easy Pass because they think they're Peter Mills.
Yeah,
you see the problem.
Yeah, one of me is enough.
Oh, I don't know about that. Let's. It was fun talking about the Turnpike Authority, which Peter, our guest, is the head of. Talk a little bit. Help me understand Maine politics, because I am a recovering politician. You, on the other hand, are still part of the political elite, and you travel in those circles with the leaders and shakers. I, of course, am bruised and battered off to the side. We're going through something now, kind of in this legislative session, a bit of a budget battle, but it feels like it's deeper than just budget philosophy. It feels like nobody in Augusta can get along, and the ideology camps are so entrenched that if one side says blue, the other side says green, good, bad. What's going on in Augusta, and since you have a longer lens than I do in terms of state legislation, is this normal, or are we entered a phase that is like totally dysfunctional?
Well, part of it is term limits and the inexperience, I think, of many of the people engaged, and I will say that about both sides. I remember when I went in my freshman year to the Senate in January of 95, Jeff Butlin was the leader of the Senate. He's now dead. Ex-Marine, he was as tough as nails, and he was very conservative, and the conservatives took over the Senate caucus, and I was one of those who was on the more moderate end of the spectrum. But I remember vividly Jeff's rule, and he was president of the Senate. Nothing in here in the caucus or outside the caucus is going to be personal. You want to debate the issue, debate it hard, but we're going at the end of the day, we're going to be friends, and no matter what our beliefs are. And that's true of the Democrats, and that's true of Angus King, who was governor. We're going to get along with them, even if we disagree with them. And I think that rule, and the other guy that really believed in that and preached it a lot was Jock McKernan. And with all of the tensions that he lived through, and they were substantial, and the closing of government in 1991 and so forth. But he lived by the rule, as did Jeff, that you do not take it to the personal level. And unfortunately, we are seeing it, that rule break down from time to time. And that it just that and once that breaks down, then you're not doing business anymore.
What's causing the breakdown? Is it more of a societal thing, or is it something specific to Maine or indigenous?
I think it's true. It's true at the national level as well. I think we're not always electing people who understand the value of maintaining what do you want to call it?
Decorum.
Decorum. Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, my good, everybody gets, you know how that you listen to the C-SPAN and these people get up and they say, oh, my good friend from Wisconsin, you know, and you can't stand the guy, but you just, there's a certain politeness about it. And if you lose that, once you lose that, even sporadically, the system of trying to compromise and come together begins to break down.
Yeah, I especially like watching or listening to parliamentary procedure in England.
So funny.
Because they add literature in great, yes. A lyrical, my good righteous friend from the Winchester Crowdy, whose head is so far up his rear behind, it makes it sound like a compliment. Say, well, thank you, my good friend, and your head is so far. And it's like, whoa, my righteous friend.
The other thing we don't have in America is we don't have the parliamentary system. In other words, we don't have the option, really, going out and starting a third party or fourth party to gather your own views around a group of people that agree with you and then launch off and become a splinter. That just isn't our way. You know, Roosevelt, the first Roosevelt, Teddy tried it with the Bull Moose Party, and it didn't survive. Angus King never really started a third party. Could have. He could still do it. He's got the personality, and he's got the following, and he's got people with money behind him. But it's not going to happen in our system. And so we have to have our fights inside the parties. And that's why you're going to have Roger Cates and the governor debating. And that's just our system.
Well, I think debates are fine, but the name-calling.
Well, that's why it can't get to name-calling.
I know.
Because then you stop making deals.
Isn't that a leadership issue, though? Like you said, you had the president of the Senate say, this is how it's going to be. It's not going to be personal. Yeah. It's got to start from the top, does it not? Yeah,
and he would bring the gavel down on the floor if you got out of hand with that rule. Bang. I mean, Master at Arms is there to usher you out if that happened. I mean, it was good.
I think if I did.
I lost my temper one time. It was a bill that went the wrong way down in the House that I had written in the Senate, and it had passed overwhelmingly. And I went bursting out of the House. Like the doors weren't even there. They were swinging doors, and they exploded like a drumhead. And I went down to the Senate. I was fuming. But almost by the time I got there, Dan Gwadowski, God bless him, was the speaker, and he sent a note down to the Senate to Jeff Butlin, and he said, Senator Mills will be welcome back in the House as soon as he apologizes for his behavior. And Jesus, I apologize immediately.
Wow.
I won't say I never lost my temper again, but I never liked that.
Well, I've got a couple thoughts I wanted to run by you again. I'm a recovering politician, so I'm looking for therapy wherever I can get it here. And you are one of the leaders in the state. I think there's two areas of grave concern in terms of our democracy and. A representative democracy requires participation from the electorate because we're a nation of laws and people have to be elected. And there should be a level of accountability for voters. When people's lives are threatened, whether it was in the birth of our country or whether then we talked earlier on about great military conflicts, I think people are more sensitized. I think if life and liberty is like imminently threatened, we have an intuitive sense, like a Darwinistic impulse, where we need the best and the brightest leading us. So at the birth of the country, you know, you had Jefferson and Franklin. Now people don't, I think, see or recognize that both the threat and the loss and the opportunity we're missing. So people, the voters, aren't as informed as they should be. And the effect of that is we are electing people that lack core competency. And something happened or was in the paper a few weeks ago with Great Northern and Kate Street, and there were the two financial groups in Louisiana, and there was a bunch of lawyers, and you know, they made a bunch of money, and the net result was a bad bill, bad legislation was passed with the best of intentions because it was going to be about economic development and helping with the paper mill, But the taxpayers of Maine are getting stuck with a $16 million bill, getting nothing out of it. The mill jobs were lost. And all the bright guys and all the smart attorneys and all the financial people are chuckling, cashing checks. They're boating. They're golfing. Right this second, they're probably out golfing. And the taxpayers don't know what's going on. And there wasn't one person on the labor committee that had business, legal, accounting experience. And basically, the state legislature last month said, hey, we weren't that sophisticated. It got by us. But a $3 billion a year state budget, a multi-billion dollar economy, requires competency. You wouldn't put those people in charge of Delta Airlines or Apple Computer, but somehow we have this sense of if a person cares about Maine or they care about their community, why wouldn't we elect them to run something? But we wouldn't do that in a commercial sense. What do you think about that?
I agree. It's a board of directors with 186 members.
Yeah.
And many of them come to it without prior business experience.
But we have an anti-business mode. Mm-hmm. I mean, I went to the Democratic convention last May, and I'm a registered Democrat because I believe in the core values. But it made me sick being there because the conversation was so angry. It was about personalized Paul LePage, who I disagree with many of his policies, and I'm not a fan of what he's done as governor, but I respect his position as governor, as elected official.
Sure.
But every politician got up and said, business is bad, elect me, I'm going to make this better. And it wasn't thoughtful. It wasn't smart. And I think it's the same thing on the Republican side. We've digressed to the point where politicians are trying to cater to like base impulse as opposed to running any business or any enterprise, running the Turnpike Authority, which by all accounts, you've been doing a great job, but you've got to be competent. You've got to understand, obviously you're a trained lawyer, but you have to understand law principles. You have to understand accounting, finance, labor. You've got a lot of employees. You have to have an understanding of healthcare. You have to know a little about engineering because when one of your chief engineers comes to you, you have to ask the right questions. Mm-hmm. If it was somebody up the street who just kind of woke up tomorrow and said, hey, I could run the Turnpike Authority, they would probably fail, and we would wonder, God, how could that happen? Mm-hmm. They really like the Turnpike, and we elect people because they like Maine or they like a town. How do we change that?
Serious business people are no longer making a commitment to run. I mean, the people like Joe Sewell, Horace Hildreth Jr., Harry Richardson, the people that were serving in the 60s and the 70s, Dave Huber, these were very serious people who were willing to run for office in those days. Today, in order to run and get elected, you have to go out and you have to go door to door to door to door to door and just to get into the House and God knows for the Senate.
Right.
And then we have these brutal campaigns.
Well, not only God knows, but I know because I lost their primary last year. Well, so it's not this global abstract thing.
No, it's very hard.
I know. But I respect the will of the voters. But in my case, the voters elected somebody who served in a local town council, didn't have business experience, didn't have in my opinion, didn't have a depth of experience or knowledge, but people said, hey, I like her. And it's like, well, likability is nice, but not when you're making decisions on a $3 billion budget and you're setting policy for a whole state.
Chuck Chinquette came down some years ago. He recruited Mickey Martin, who was a Republican, to come in. Mickey called me after 2 years, and I took over part of Mickey's district that was redistricting, so I was only running. He called me up. His pitch to me to get me to run was Mills. You got to get down here. Maybe you can stand this place. I hate it.
Wow. Well, that's a nice pitch. That's a compelling pitch.
I said, gee, thanks, Mickey.
but you and I have met a number of times, and I've met other members of your family, Janet and Dora, and you and I probably politically on some key issues really disagree. But I can sit across from you and go, Peter's a sharp guy. He processes. He's thoughtful. And he may come up with different results in terms of his critical thinking, but you're capable. And whether or not we disagree politically, whether it's you holding the position now at the Turnpike Authority or elected position, I can say, well, geez, I respect your competency. But we keep electing people, and we're disassociated the concept of competency from I like this person, or they're as angry as I am. Mm-hmm. And so if they're as angry as I am, that must be a great recipe for overseeing, you know, all the state policies.
It's very, very hard. I've done a lot of recruiting, and it's very hard to convince people. I remember a car dealer in one district who was approached to run, very well known, could very easily have won. And he says, who's running the other side? And they gave him the name, and he says, oh, well, he can't win. Well, he did win because this guy who was so prominent wasn't going to do it. And so the Republican side didn't muster an appropriate candidate, and we lost. But, I mean, business people, it's very, very time-consuming. It takes you completely out of your comfortable environment. I tell lawyers who want to run, I say, you have to get out from behind your oak desk and your panel doors, and you've got to go find where your clients live. Whether it's the end of a dirt road in a trailer park, that's where you've got to go, and you've got to sit down with them in their kitchens. I says, this is tough stuff. It's demeaning, and at times it is.
Yeah.
And you got to fight off the dogs, and you've got to go. And I says, that's what it is nowadays. My dad, when he ran for the Senate back in the 50s, and well, he started running, and he was in the House in 38.
Wow.
But campaigning in those days was you bought 500 pencils, and you stuck them in a coffee cup on the counter of the law office. And that was it. Had your name on them. And then you got elected because everybody knew you because you did town meetings and stuff. But those days are gone.
I know. I mean, talking about campaigning, at this Democratic convention last May, one of the sessions was how to do what they call doors, right?
Oh, yeah.
And the person who was speaking said, my secret to doing doors, and this is where you knock on a door and you say, I'm a candidate for what, is to always go when there's a giant rainstorm. And it was like, it's counterintuitive. And people say, well, why would you go when it's a thunderstorm? Well, because it's great. You go on the door, you look miserable, you hand the pamphlet, the people feel bad for you, and they vote for you. And I said, yeah, I guess that's how our democracy should work. That's what the founders were thinking. Whoever was the most miserable coming to the door obviously should be the leader. And my final anecdote is, you know, somebody said, well, you know, competency is overrated. And I said, well, you know, if Deb fell off her chair right now, and, you know, God forbid, and her leg breaks and the FEMA or FIRMA or something is coming
out. Through,
oh,
yeah.
You're in writhing pain. It would be like, hey, Deb, where do you want to go? Deb would go, oh, I think Maine Med makes the most sense.
Sure.
Because they're known as an institution with competency. And we go, how do you want to get there? Do you want to take a bike? No, ambulance, because, you know, ambulances are comp. And then once we get there, what do you think? Would you like to see an OBYG? No, I want to see an orthopedic surgeon. And then it'll be like, finally, Deb, what do you think? Anesthesia? You want to go with some anesthesia?
Yeah.
And at each step, we recognize the competency of that process. But in the political government realm, we think there's no competency. We think it's just showing up and going, hey, I like Falmouth, or I like Biddeford, or I like Maine. And until we recognize we need to elect more thoughtful people, regardless of the party, then we're going to end up where we ended up. Well, I don't know if we solved anything here today, Peter, but I feel better.
Good therapy for both of us.
I know. Now,
Debbie included.
Debbie and Sully. By the way, thank you so much for coming by. And we started the conversation talking about Memorial Weekend, and this will be airing tomorrow. And I also want to reflect upon that and thank you for your service and for all the veterans that are both listening and for all the families that have had members serve in the military and for those who have made the ultimate sacrifice. It's a somber and weekend, and one that I think that we should all reflect on and commemorate however we see fit. But I hope you come back sometime.
It's always a pleasure here.
It's great.
We've got the finest studio in Southern Maine. It's great.
Thank you very much. We've had Peter Mills, Executive Director of the Maine Turnpike Authority. You've been listening to Tide Smart Talk with Steve-O, News Talk WLOB, 1310 a.m. Have a great Memorial Weekend. We'll be back next week.